I'm very happy now to welcome Jerry Sabloff. He's president of the Santa Fe Institute, and we're here to talk about the Mayan calendar, archaeology, and pseudo-archaeology. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great being here again.
So this is our conversation here is taking place on the occasion of the end of the Mayan calendar, which is going to be, what, Friday or Saturday?
Friday, the end of an important cycle in the Maya calendar. It's not the end of the Maya calendar. In fact, I think it's quite clear that the Maya did not think the world was going to end on the winter solstice on Friday, December 21st, 2012.
And so let's talk actually for a moment about what their calendar was/is and how it's been used all these years.
The Maya, whose civilization flourished in what's now the greater Yucatan Peninsula, in countries such as Guatemala, Belize, Mexico, Salvador, Honduras, thrived at least as early as 1,000 years before the Common Era, and then continued right on up until the Spanish conquest in the 16th century. It was really an extraordinary complex civilization. They were sophisticated farmers, sculptors, and obviously scientists. They, through naked eye astronomy, they were able to understand the movements of not only the sun and the moon, but planets such as Venus. They could predict various kinds of eclipses, the movement of these various planets, as well as the stars. We know, they knew various constellations. For example, the one we think of, the Pleiades, today, and particularly movement of sun and the moon, fairly regular and kind of long-term observation. But Venus is much more erratic. It appears as both the morning and evening star, and is not as readily predictable as the sun and the moon. But they understood all of those. They had a mathematical system that included the concept of zero. And interestingly enough, it was a vagismal system. So the base number was 20 rather than our decimal system of 10.
Oh, that's so interesting. So hands and feet.
Exactly. And I think fair to say that they viewed the world in a cyclical manner. There were cycles of varying lengths, of ones that we would think now as the calendar year, and then much longer cycles. And they actually had calendrics that were a mixture of different cycles working together. But they also had kind of great cycles. And one of them will end, projecting in time, on December 21st, 2012. But the end of one cycle did not mean even the great cycle, the end of the world. That cycle would end and a new cycle would begin. And the Maya were making predictions and retrodictions on carvings, on monuments, on painting, on ceramics, and then later on bark paper books. Both well in the past and well in the future. And I think a nice way to think about the cyclicality of the Maya calendar, one of my colleagues, I think was on NPR radio some time ago, but I've heard this from others, think about your car. If you're really lucky, you're driving along, you look at the odometer and it says 99,999 miles. And then the tenth of the miles go up and it goes 8, 9, and then suddenly the whole array goes to zero. Your car doesn't explode. The world around you doesn't disappear. The road isn't gone. In fact, it starts again. And if you're really lucky, in another 99,000 miles, 99,909, the same thing happens, and it goes on. That's the Maya calendar. We think of it even with cars, that's an important milestone. It's past a major milestone. You start another one. And the same with the Maya. So I will bet you and all your viewers that when you wake up on Friday morning, on 21st of December, if the weather's good, the sun will rise. If not, it'll still get light before 7 o'clock in the morning, and the day will go on as usual. The Maya didn't predict the world would end. And if anything happens to the world, it had absolutely nothing to do with the Maya. This is a whole made-up apocalypse that, good news, it's made a lot of people money, writing books, being on, on television, so it might even, for the millions of Maya speakers who still survive in Mexico and Guatemala and other parts of Central America, maybe with all the tourist dollars of people, spend the last day of the world at Chichen Itza, let alone Cancun. Can you think of a better or worse place to spend December 21st and not wake up on December 20th, not wake up on the 21st? Anyway, if they get some tourist dollars, that's probably good. But the modern Maya themselves, who are the descendants of the Maya civilization in pre-Columbian times, they don't take this seriously
right.
at all. I mean, at least I've read, I mean, I haven't spoken to any of them in person, but I've read a lot of interviews in papers and talking to colleagues and so on. They don't take this particularly seriously. But as I say, if a side benefit is increased tourist dollars and more attention from their governments and so on, so be it.
Well, that's perfectly nice, but it doesn't have anything to do with science or astronomy or archaeology.
Not anything. This is this kind of whole world of made-up science, if you will, or pseudoscience in general, pseudo-archaeology, as you mentioned at the beginning.
Now, what is the significance of the kind of going back to zero? Is it associated with any astronomical events? Is Venus or the moon or the sun or something lining up with...
No, this is the calendar itself. This date happens to fall on the winter solstice, but no great alignments or anything of the sort.
And no thousand years of peace and harmony either.
No, I mean, that's a nice thought, but it has nothing to do with the nature of ancient Maya civilization.
All right, so let's talk for a moment about pseudo-archaeology. How did it come to pass that this ending has been turned into, this ending of the cycle that you mentioned has turned into such a huge kind of media event and people believing the world might end or something like that?
The answer is I don't know. One can speculate. We're living in an age where views of the apocalypse, now seem to be more prevalent than ever. And obviously with the nature of our global communications and any kinds of speculations and that sort seem to get much wider currency. So that may be one, that there may be others as well. I think one of the kind of the underlying themes is a failure of education systems around the world in terms of understanding science in general, and archaeology in particular, understanding of ancient peoples around the world. I think scientists, educators, and the media have not done a great job in educating people in all countries, but particularly in the United States, as we know. I think that it's just not at the level that it should be. Many people don't really understand the nature of the scientific method, how science works, how it brings forth hypotheses, how it tests them, the nature of more established scientific theories and the role of scientific thinking. And this is, and without that kind of baseline of knowledge, of a large portion of the population, it becomes much easier for what I would think of as pseudoscientific in general, in this case pseudo-archaeological kinds of speculations to gain currency, because too many people don't have the tools on which to evaluate these claims and say that's ludicrous. There are better, more grounded, more proven explanations available than the ones that one's reading in the paper or seeing on TV. And say that there are just a host of examples of that in archaeology, but one can go well beyond that in a variety of realms of science. So it's unfortunately, it's a failure of those of us who are scientists. I think not enough of us are working to try to educate the public at large rather than communicating just with our fellow scientists. But I think it's clearly also a failure, at least in part, of our educational system, that kids in junior high school and high school are not learning the nature of science.
And the basic kinds of inquiry that you do. So, for example, when people talk about the pyramids, and there's a lot of archaeology and a lot of pseudo-archaeology, you've got the Egyptian pyramids, and then you've got these pyramids or pyramid-like structures in present-day Mexico and Guatemala, and there are pseudo-archaeologists that said, oh, they learned, what do they say? You tell us.
No. Well, I mean, that somehow the Egyptians taught the peoples in Mexico and Central America how to build pyramids. The only problem with that is the Great Pyramids at Giza were built in the early dynasty and probably date at least 3,000 years before the major pyramids, say, at Teotihuacan in the Valley of Mexico, and some of the large pyramids, for example, the ones at Tikal, are even, you know, are more. They're 3,500 years and so on. So first of all, the timing's totally off. But beyond that, there's absolutely no empirical physical evidence of Egyptian presence in Mexico and Central America. So both in terms of the data, let alone the timing, something like that, you know, doesn't work. But I think one sees a lot of that kind of speculation. The pyramids are just one example. In fact, peoples around the world, ancient peoples, you know, right on up to today, have built structures that reach towards the sky. And maybe pyramids, it may be ziggurats, it may be stupas, it may be Gothic cathedrals, it may be skyscrapers. We're always having constructions where height and monumental size are really important. And I think these are aspects of human aspirations and culture, not that it only happened once and then spread. I think in part, and a number of my colleagues have written about this, but it's really true that in our modern age, we tend to discount the incredible ingenuity and technical inventiveness of our predecessors around the world, no matter what the technological level, whether they use stone tools, metal tools, or what have you. People were and are incredibly inventive, and it's not surprising to find major milestones in human culture. For example, the rise of agriculture happened independently a variety of times in different parts of the world, and that's a major invention. But it repeats the same with the rise of cities, of states, of various kinds of technology, metallurgy, as an example. These don't just happen once. I mean, there may be, you know, some examples, but by and large, people's inventiveness wins out, and you don't need to look for one place. Egypt, as an example, where all spreads, and so I think in part that there's a lack of appreciation of the achievements of peoples in the ancient world, and plus, and in most cases, I think it's unknowingly a kind of racism. Like, how could the ancient Maya, with stone tools, have come up with this sophisticated astronomical observations, with this mathematical systems, with a hieroglyphic writing system, with their beautiful sculptures, their monumental art and architecture? It must have come from some other more advanced people. And whether those advanced people were Egyptians or one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel, or even more fanciful to the point of ancient astronauts a la Eric von Däniken arriving and teaching the poor benighted Maya how to read and write and build monuments. It's saying these people are not capable of doing it themselves, and we must look elsewhere, and be that across the ocean, let alone up in the skies of some unproven kinds of extraterrestrials. Although it's interesting, it's surprising, in fact, that many of these extraterrestrial explanations, they're anthropomorphic. They're like us in similar kinds of spaceships that need landing strips and so on and so forth. And it's interesting, some years ago, when von Däniken, soon after, I guess, he first wrote Chariots of the Gods, or one of his other books, was on a book tour. I was teaching at Harvard then, and one of the Boston morning shows called me up and said, would I appear with him on TV?
Now, let's back up for a second. Yeah. Who is this guy, Eric von Däniken?
He's literally was a businessman. He, in fact, wrote Chariots of the Gods, which have sold, I don't know how many millions of copies.
Tens of millions.
And there's been a TV show, there's a movie and so on. He wrote it while he was sitting in debtor's prison in Austria.
For financial fraud.
Right. And this, you know, he was looking, I guess, at ways of making money and getting out. So a lot of this, you know, and he'd read certain of the archaeologists made out of whole cloth. So here he is on his book tour promoting this. Scholars will look at it and say, it's just so far beyond the pale, it's hard to imagine. And so there, I was arguing some specifics where, you know, say he's looking at the tomb of one of the great rulers at the Maya city of Palenque.
So you're on the morning show with him in Boston.
And I'm kind of saying, this is just not true. We can see kind of long in the archaeological record how many of these cultural traits evolved over long periods of time and changed and have long history. We can see how they developed. We went back and forth. I finally said, do you know that at the bottom, all the kind of examples that features in the book, the Maya, the Egyptian pyramids, Stonehenge, that lines on the desert in the southern coast of the Andes. You know, one could go on those, that there, you know, tend to be what we would think of now as kind of poor native peoples, third world countries. And so, okay, how come you never have the ancient astronauts coming down, say, at the Sistine Chapel and helping Michelangelo paint the ceiling? And von Däniken looks at me and said, my next book. But of course, he never wrote that next book. It was always these kind of native civilizations in different parts of the world. Western, modern, or historic Western world never figures in. And I would not say that he was a racist. I just have no knowledge of that. But I think the underlying theme, if not racist, is one that undervalues the achievements of ancient peoples around the world. And Chariots of the Gods is just one of the more popular examples, but there's certainly tons of others that one could cite.
And Chariots of the Gods basically saying that ancient astronauts came to Earth and built the big monuments.
No, they didn't build them themselves, but they showed the people who were living there
how to build them.
So
so paternalistic.
Let me use another really popular example, which is different, but the theme is identical. Think of Stanley Kubrick's 2001, based on the Arthur Clarke novel. If you remember, a key turning point is you have the apes around a small water hole, and suddenly there's the great black slab, and under the influence of this black slab, they invent tools. And then later on, there's another black slab on the moon, which pushes technology, which acts as a technology at this point and pushes it on. But the opening one saying that the progression of primate evolution and then human evolution was not something that occurred naturally, but had this external force from somewhere in the stars that put the black slab there that made that possible. Whereas we literally, in archaeological sequences, in human biological, you can show long, literally logical sequences of development. It's not that out of the blue you had the black slab or an ancient astronaut or some kind of lost great civilization arriving and teaching these people, these don't occur that way. I think we can show how the local people, in many cases, understandably, through innovation, invention, came to these new understandings, new kinds of constructions, new kinds of technologies, and so on. And to me, what's interesting is that talk to some people and say, well, people are looking for a more kind of spectacular kind of explanation. But it seems to me that looking at how peoples became more complex through time, different cultures in different parts of the world, that's a fantastic, exciting story. And that's when earlier when I said, I think we, in a sense, as a profession, in this case, archaeologists, but this is true in other scientific areas, have not succeeded in imparting that kind of excitement of what I think is the real story versus ones that are, in effect, speculation and make-believe, and also in allowing people to understand or at least gain the tools that they can evaluate, say, an archaeological explanation of what happened with the Maya and a von Däniken-like ancient astronauts. And you say, okay, what's the physical evidence? And they'll point to, well, is this monument showing an ancient astronaut at the controls of a spaceship? And in fact, it's and he's kind of pushed back by the accelerations they're taking off. In that specific case, it actually, we can, through the iconography and the decipherment, hieroglyphic writing, and its placement, know it's the tomb of a known person at a known time. And in fact, that particular depiction shows him descending into the underworld at his death, and you can show how that's the case, and there's the history before that and the history after that, and there's absolutely not an iota of evidence that would indicate that this was a spaceship with ancient astronauts, the equivalent of the black slab, kind of radiating knowledge to the Maya. One can go kind of case after case after that, where there's a terrific precedent. The pyramids in Egypt didn't appear out of nothing. It's not that we're ignorant of how they're built. Excavations in recent years have uncovered literally the where the laborers were living, working, all the craftspeople involved in that. Stonehenge, there's been a huge amount of archaeological work. We know and Stonehenge, you know, is not the, kind of the only standing stone, you know, monument. There are others throughout the British Isles, France, Spain, and elsewhere. And also, in Stonehenge case, we can see the buildup. We know where various kinds of stone, through sophisticated technical analysis of the geology of the stones, there's now a good idea of how they were transported, how you know, the stones were erected, and so on. This is not unknown. Or, as I used to point out to my students, it's not all mysterious. Mysterious is a word that particularly television loves, but you see it in a variety of it. And yeah, especially with the Maya, because it's alliterative. So if you see a TV program about the Maya, it's always the mysterious Maya. And I used to joke that if you had a narration, it almost always would be Leonard Nimoy from Star Trek. For some, no, obviously it's others, but there's kind of a form that television likes of this sort, and creating mysteries. And in part, archaeologists certainly don't have full explanations or understanding, but it doesn't mean that if it's not absolute, you know, this, then it's a mystery. In fact, most of these are not mysteries at all. But that seems to, or at least the thought is in various media, that this kind of approach excites the public.
Well, maybe there were things that were mysteries that were solved by archaeologists.
Right. No, I mean, in one sense, you know, at some point in past time, before knowledge has built up a certain point, it might seem to be a mystery. But in most of these cases, particularly the spectacularly visual ones that speculation centers on, you know, we have really good information. And in fact, with the host of scientific techniques that archaeologists can now bring to bear, you know, really a wide toolkit of chemical, biological, remote sensing, all kinds of different approaches to, you know, to the past, we now have much fuller, stronger, richer understandings, say, in the last 20 years than we've ever had before. And I think, I say, our task is really to do a better job of imparting that kind of information to the public. And we just don't see it as much as we should.
We're talking to archaeologist Jerry Sabloff, president of the Santa Fe Institute. One of the things that I can't help but think of, when, especially with the Mayan example, is people from southern Mexico and Guatemala in our culture are seen as immigrants at the bottom of the totem pole. And so when you talk about lack of imagination, I mean, part of the lack of imagination is seeing these people as the descendants of a great civilization that knew the location of Venus, observing with the naked eye.
There are all kinds of disconnects like that. And you know, as we know, civilizations rise and fall, and they have through long periods of time. In many cases, there are modern descendants, and there are interesting links to the past. But you're right. Again, I think one can do a stronger, better job of showing the links and changes through time in many of these cases.
I can't help but think that part of your work is similar to forensics. So you don't just come in with, oh, I think the butler did it. You come in and look at the physical evidence and try to figure out who did what when.
Exactly. Now, I mean, it's not to say you might not have a working hypothesis, but then you're going to look to strongly be able to support that, or find that you need to come up with a new one, because all of these different lines of empirical evidence don't support your initial hypothesis, or where you can show similar kinds of developments in different parts of the world that you know are not connected, and that there might be general trends in the development of human cultures and of civilizations through time and space.
Well, I was going to say, when you were talking about the pyramids developing in different places at vastly different times, I don't think any civilization really kind of invented the triangle or the pyramid shape. I mean, these are things that people tend to come up with.
Right. I mean, certainly if you look at kind of common geometric patterns, and someone will say, look, here's one from East Asia, and here's one in the Americas, there must be a connection. But in fact, again, looking at human perception of the world around them, circles, triangles, squares, you know, a host of crosses, these are not surprisingly very common kinds of symbols that we see through time. So what I think would be more surprising, given that the nature of the human brain, of the world around us, that we wouldn't see independently variety of people, you know, find the same kinds of geometric and natural forms. That would be surprising, not the fact that they have.
That they come up with it,
right.
Yeah. And, I mean, there are cases of people who had the cross form, and then when Christian missionaries came in, it was easier for them to colonize and convert those people because they had the same form.
Right, but it's not because they've been, you know, exposed
to... There was no previous connection
right. with Christianity. I think the other thing to emphasize in this is not just a modern phenomenon, if you will, a contemporary one, where you have ancient astronauts or black slabs, you know, in Africa and the moon and so on. Just in this country, one can go back certainly to the founding of our country and see similar kinds of what I would think of kind of archaeology versus pseudo-archaeology, you know, kinds of debates and so on that were very popular. One example would be right here in the eastern United States. Where as the frontier moved from the East Coast further west, it's hard to think today, say, of Pittsburgh as on the frontier, but it was in the 18th century, and you know even into the beginning of the 19th. But as various explorers, but trappers and military and so on started moving further west, they started seeing all kinds of mounds. I mean, large earthen mounds, and not surprisingly, and places where as settlers were moving north and west in the military are locations that were terrific for settlement, where two major rivers come together or several streams, and there's a rise over, you know, a bluff overlooking the air. So it's defensible. You have great agricultural land. You have lines of communication along, you know, rivers and streams and so on.
How big were these mounds?
They could go 25, 35, 50 feet or more in height and larger. I mean, these are substantial. In fact, in some cases, they might even look like small hills, but people found eroding from the sides or they would dig into them. All kinds of you know, sophisticated artifacts and designs, iconography, and then obviously human burials and others as well. And these are found anywhere from western New York throughout Ohio, and as you go more towards Indiana, Illinois, into Tennessee, Kentucky, and so on, all in that area. And there arose at that time, certainly, I say at the end of the 18th into the 19th century, the idea that these had been built by some mysterious, what was called the lost race of the mound builders, who had built them. And so speculation were incredible. As one of the 10 lost tribes, Vikings, looking down towards the south, maybe it was Aztecs or Toltecs who were just being, you know, discovered and had what seemed to be a very kind of sophisticated civilization, and ignoring the obvious hypothesis, which were the local Native American peoples who were living in that area. And I mean, clearly, one of the motivations for this, the promulgation of the lost race of mound builders, was they did not want to give credit to the natives. In fact, if you were taking their land, it was easier to say it hadn't been here a long time. They hadn't had a more sophisticated civilization that could build these mounds, create these artifacts, trade for the goods and so on. And moreover, they said, look at them now. They're not building the mounds and so on. And this was a really popular view. I mean, when kind of looking back now, books that were published, if you take kind of the size of the population on the East Coast of the new United States and the first 13 states and so on, and the number of books published would be multi-million sellers today, given the same, And say the speculation was rampant, and it wasn't until you started getting what we would think the beginnings of modern archaeological research and careful mapping and excavation of these mounds that started, especially in the kind of late 1840s, and then through the 19th century, the new Smithsonian Institution and Bureau of American Ethnology and other groups were able to, I think, conclusively show before the close of the 19th century that, in fact, you could show that the ancestors of the modern Native Americans, you know, living in those areas had built these mounds. This was part of Native American history.
There's an interesting example that this makes me think of, and that is, I talked to some people who studied wolves, and it turns out that there's an alpha male and an alpha female, and the alpha female calls the shots, but nobody in in who studied wolves understood that until there started to be female researchers. When it was only male researchers mm-hmm. studying wolf packs, they couldn't see mm-hmm. the alpha female as leading the pack. They just
right.
And when you talk about this example, I mean, were they literally unable to see it, or did they see it and were unwilling to go there?
That's a good question, Rashad. I don't know the answer definitively. I think it's probably both, that the mind is conditioned in many states, you know, not to see something, or as you say, they didn't want to see what they something they didn't want to be, and so I'm not quite clear. But I suspect it's a combination yeah. Of both. But I think in many cases it's the former. What seems to you, you know, kind of either impossible or not relevant, you tend not to see. Just to give you a different kind of archaeological example, much of my own field research on ancient Maya civilization has focused on, in a sense, the bulk of the population. In modern parlance, it would be, I was interested in the 99%, in the peasants, the agriculturists, the, you know, the craftspeople, artisans, and so on, and not in as much in the elite rulers. So when you know, kind of mapping ancient Maya urban areas and cities, you know, looking for the remains of the peasants were often in kind of wooden thatched houses. Of course, they didn't survive in time in a tropical thing, but one could find often the foundations of these perishable houses, unlike the well-constructed palaces and multi-room stone structures of the elite. And going back to archaeologists working in the Maya area in the 20s and 30s, where the focus was on the ruling elite and the great achievements in art and architecture and the stone buildings, you literally have discussions where they saw these small little mounds, which we now know, you know, were the remains of these perishable peasant houses, but they didn't even put them on the map because in some cases time was short and they were just seen as unimportant. They weren't stone structures, but by not appearing on the map, they weren't there. And so when other scholars were looking at the maps, you had all these standing structures. And so if you asked how many people lived at this archaeological site, they couldn't answer. Or right. If they did, it was way off, because I think one would kindly say there was a sampling error. In the sense, they didn't see something that they didn't think was important, even though, in fact, in some cases, it certainly registered, it was on their consciousness, but they just dismissed it. And so I think that as you point out, that's certainly one of the elements in the case of the supposed lost race of the mound builders. But I think that there's, as well, at least in some cases, a political undercurrent as well in terms of not linking Native American populations who were being pushed off, you know, their land, and not give them, you know, roots in the area or a more, might want to think, a heroic, complex past.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. If you look at these people who are actually living here mm-hmm. and say these people have tremendous monuments and we're right. looking at them, then you can't make these excuses in their mind about why they shouldn't be on their own land.
Right. And in fact, I mean, if you just, in terms of simplicity, one would have thought the first argument would have been it's the local people who did it, not bringing in some right. mysterious lost race who would have done that. So what we're seeing today has long, and I'm sure in other countries one can find similar kinds of examples, but I think the difference is today we really have, in many areas, terrific, rich, scientific archaeological evidence that can be brought to bear on all kinds of questions, so that there's not as much excuse of where in times when those data were either non-existent or spotty, and today. And so I think, to get back to what I said, we need to do a better job of making people aware of that kind of richness.
We're talking to Jerry Sabloff about archaeology and pseudo-archaeology. Now, I suppose, I mean, I would think it would be challenging to try to figure out what are the prejudices that we have today that make us blind to what we're actually looking at?
That's a terrific point. And the answer is absolutely, we have to be as aware as we can of the, it's not that modern archaeologists are going to be unbiased, but what we need to do is always to try to recognize those biases and see how they might influence what we're seeing or how we're interpreting evidence that we get. You're not going to get someone who's completely unbiased. It doesn't work. The question is how hidden those biases are and how we can make ourselves aware of them, or at least in argument, you know, see how they're influencing opinions.
And I would think it's also important to get archaeologists from different races and classes and genders and all that.
Absolutely. And you know, for example, the Society for American Archaeology, which is the major archaeological organization in the United States, has been working hard in recent years to get a variety of minority groups, Native populations involved in archaeology. And we're seeing some terrific progress in this regard. Here in the Southwest, for example, a number of the Puebloan groups, among others, now have their own archaeological units who are undertaking conservation, preservation, or even mitigation in the face of development on their own lands. And I think that's been a terrific development, and where they are able to control the archaeology on their lands. And I think in most cases working very cooperatively with non-native archaeologists in this regard, that's been a terrific development. And then globally, the growth of indigenous archaeological services. Mexico, for example, has a terrific National Institute of Anthropology and History. They have, you know, schools where they train archaeologists, anthropologists, all kinds of technicians, have the laboratories for forensic work and so on, and then also issue the permits for non-Mexicans to come in and control where they're working under what kinds of regulations and so on. And this is true throughout Central America and certainly in South America as well. These are growing. They have excellent educational systems and have a whole cadre of archaeologists in each of these countries. And this is a growing worldwide phenomenon. So it's not only archaeologists from the United States or Western Europe who are doing this work. They're often working in close conjunction with archaeologists in these areas. Some years ago, when I was director of the University of Pennsylvania Museum in Philadelphia, which had at that time projects, archaeological projects, in I think between 15 and 20 countries around the world, in almost every case, we had to get permits from the national authorities in each of these countries, and we're working closely with archaeologists in each one of these countries.
And when you did that, did you find that they brought you perspectives and ways of thinking that you hadn't?
Absolutely, and vice versa. I think having those kind of cooperative projects where you had both project directors as co-directors from different countries, as well as students from both countries working together, that really enriched the kinds of hypotheses that were put forward and the kinds of lines of research that looked for evidence to support or reject those hypotheses. And also, it was true, same working in Yucatan, we often got valuable perspectives from the workers who we'd hired to work, yeah, you know, with us, where there might be, in some cases, although they'd been changed, certain kinds of continuities from the past to the present, and they would have perspectives. Or it simply could be their knowledge of the environment and its resources, which either were different or new to North American archaeologists coming down and working in the area.
When you're looking at a place that is, you know, 1,000 years old or more, and then the people, the descendants of the people who built that place are there, do you find that there generally is a continuity of culture that helps you to understand that place?
Rashad, it varies incredibly. In some cases, the answer is yes. In many cases, no. I mean, there may be terrific discontinuities, or the descendants who are living there now may not see any cultural or physical connection to the remains of the past. And there are certain colleagues of mine now who are working in the Maya area, is just one example, to educate children now, as well as adults, descendants of the ancient Maya, about their history. The argument that, again, there are various kinds of communities we serve, and I've been talking about kind of general education in this country about archaeology, in particular science in general, but there's also an obligation to the local people as well, and there's several groups now that are working and trying to build up understanding, say, even among school kids, about their past in general, and then specifically some of the remains of their past that might be in the neighborhood where there have been tremendous continuities. And I found, in talking to the workers, that they were fascinated. I mean, as I say, they were giving us new insights, but they were fascinated to learn more about the past that we could tell them as we were working. So at its best, it's a mutual interplay where the archaeologists learn from the native peoples, or at least the indigenous people in that area, descendants, and vice versa. The local people can gain understanding from the archaeologists. And if the archaeological team has both the local and non-local working together, that even improves the synergy and the interchange of ideas.
I think one of the reasons that pseudo-archaeology can capture the imagination of people is it focuses on the things that regular people look at. For example, when you look at the Nazca lines in Peru, the thing that non-archaeologists are struck by is that A, they're so beautiful, and B, they made these things on the ground that only make sense when they're seen from the air.
Well, I think certainly that's a particularly spectacular example, but there's been a lot of work recently, and in some cases, these are actually ways of people in one area pointing to the importance of some natural phenomenon or cultural phenomenon in another. They're actually kinds of lines of sight or links. In other cases, they're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it for the gods in the heavens. So even if the pattern, they only see one part of the pattern as they're walking on the ground, they know that the gods can see them and appreciate them. So they have certainly a religious, ideological importance. So they're probably a combination of both practical and ideological. Always found it fascinating, you go back to our earlier study, that a von Däniken or other looking at ancient astronauts, and this has been pointed out a number of times, why should we think these sophisticated extraterrestrials from who knows where in the heavens, and it's never made quite clear, that they would be flying the kinds of spaceships that needed runways just like our multi-engine planes. If they can do, presuming that they could just land on the spot, they wouldn't need the equivalent of a runway. I've always felt that's kind of fascinating, that somehow these incredible sophisticated creatures from elsewhere are going to be flying planes like ours.
Well, the claim being that the Nazca lines are astronaut runways for space people.
Right.
Well, it's like Scientology, the idea that these people from 80 million years ago flew DC-10s.
It seems to me that it's like the most exciting kind of science fiction, ones that break the boundaries, that don't totally anthropomorphize peoples from different times and different parts of the galaxy and so on. Some of the most interesting ones are ones where the author can imagine intelligence and development that's totally different from what we see. That, to me, is more imaginative than just seeing them as images of ourselves. Let alone even when you blend it, the famous Star Wars, but you see them in different science fiction of a bar with different kinds of creatures sitting there. But why would do we envision a bar as we would in our world today,
right?
Wouldn't it might be something totally different. So there's an imagination, but it stops instead of taking it all away, if you will.
Well, and it's much harder.
Yeah, absolutely. But things like ancient astronauts creating the Nazca lines as runways for their vehicles, to me, is not a very imaginative exercise. And people, as they should. One hopes should not be fooled into believing that.
Now, we've talked about pyramids, mounds in Ohio, the Mayan calendar, the Nazca lines. We haven't really talked about Stonehenge that much. But when you see these great human achievements that really do capture the imagination of people and that tourists go to see these things and so on, where are the actual controversies in some of these really well-known ones that archaeologists are still arguing about?
No, well, I think one could cite chapter and verse on that. Sometimes the arguments are simple of dating. When exactly were these great monuments built? How long did they take to build, and so on? Those kinds of arguments, still rage.
But we don't care as much about those.
No,
I mean, we care about things like, what was Stonehenge?
Right. And I think, by and large, today, those kinds of arguments are rather few and far between. I think where there's been a lot of archaeological research, kind of what the function was, who built them, are not as much of an argument as might seem, at least in the public view. They tend to be much more specific about questions of the sources of some of the raw materials. What was the organization of that particular society that enabled them to harness the labor to move, in this case, large stones to build them? So, did they have kings and queens? Were there marketplaces? Was the labor voluntary? Was it coerced? what are their monetary or other kinds of material rewards? Those are the kinds of arguments that rage among archaeologists and the archaeological literature. Not these kind of basic ones that the public sees in terms of time. The kind of who, what, when questions are less important in archaeology, and the most of the controversy is in what we would think of why and how.
And that makes for a very interesting point that I've heard you make before, namely that it's important to think of archaeology in a way as a branch of anthropology and social science, which is you're not looking at what are these objects and idols and sort of Indiana Jones things that we're pulling out of the ground, but rather who were these people, how did they live, how is it like other societies, how is it different, how did they evolve from the thing that came before?
Right. No, that's a terrific point. And one can use the Indiana Jones example, say the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where he's going into this cave and grabbing what we would think of actually looting a gold statue, and then trying to run away from the local people who resent him stealing that. I think to certainly the overwhelming majority of archaeologists today, that statue would be of interest, not just as an interesting art object or something valuable because it's made in a value, what we see today as a valuable material. But what would that particular statue tell us about, how can its location tell us about the rituals? Will there be iconography and symbolism that will allow us to understand their religion, their practice? What kind of trade? Was that gold local? Did they have to trade for it? If so, how? Did they send people out to mine it, or were they trading with people who collected the gold? Who was making it? Who was supporting the people? Or if they were doing it full-time, who was supplying them with food? Were they being paid? All of those has to understand the culture, or if in more complex cases, the civilization, how all that was. That's what interests our archaeologists. That's the kind of how and why question, not just what is the date, or can I bring another wonderful object back to a museum? Archaeology was like that well in the past. But modern archaeology, as you mentioned, is really a social science trying to understand the nature of peoples of the past, how they built up their civilization, how they were able to sustain it in different conditions. And that's where I think archaeology becomes beyond its kind of humanistic, it's interesting to know about peoples of the past, much more of a social science and relevant today. If we can understand how people successfully or unsuccessfully survived different kinds of changing conditions, be they environment, in the environment or cultural, that won't give us a blueprint for surviving in the world today, but I think might give us useful perspectives. I've written, for example, along with colleagues, if you look at the effects of major droughts on ancient Maya peoples, that won't tell us how to survive droughts, but see some interesting perspectives. How were they able to continue to thrive under certain drought conditions, and in other cases not be able to sustain their lives? And I think that's directly relevant today, as we understand more and more of ancestral Pueblo past. I think that can give us important new perspectives on sustaining and surviving in a Southwest that clearly is going to be has faced and will face significant drought conditions in the future.
And meanwhile, we're pretty confident that we're going to survive Friday, December 21st.
Right. There may be a variety of unknowns in archaeology today, but if there's one thing I'm absolutely certain is that anyone who's listening to your program, let alone those who are not smart enough to be doing so, will awake on the morning of December 21st and be thankful that the world is still there.
And maybe we'll even make it to Christmas.
We hope.
Jerry Sabloff is an archaeologist. He's president of the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.